Malcolm Gladwell is here, and we are in the middle of our fund drive. I don't want to make tipping point jokes or anything like that, but perhaps this is the tipping point. And maybe you can do the tipping by giving us a call at 1-888-376-9692. Pledge online at WNYC.org. You'll be automatically entered in this incredible nine-day Southern African Safari package where you might, if you win, we'll spend 6 days in safari in Botswana, 3 days in Cape Town, South Africa. You have to call. You don't have to become a member, but you have to call. And when you're calling, you might consider also getting a full year of The New Yorker. 12 months is our way of saying thank you for a gift of $10 a month. If you already are a subscriber to The New Yorker, we will just add 12 months to your subscription. Call now, 1-888-376-9692, or pledge online at WNYC.org.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Malcolm Gladwell's most recent books, The Tipping Point in 2000, Blink 2005, and Outliers 2008, have each reached number one on the New York Times bestseller list. His feature articles in The New Yorker have been among the magazine's most popular. And now, in his latest book, What the Dog Saw and Other Adventures, he's collected some of his most provocative New Yorker essays. And I'm very pleased that it has brought him to our show. By the way, Malcolm Gladwell was named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in 2005. The book is published by Little Brown. It's always a pleasure to see you, Malcolm.
Yes, happy to be back.
Do you think that the popular success you've experienced over the years, especially during the past 5 or 6 years, has changed your ability to meet with subjects and conduct your research? I mean, you say, hi, I'm Malcolm Gladwell. They already have a pretty good idea of what you're up to, don't they?
I suppose. I mean, what opens the door is the affiliation with The New Yorker. So it was never difficult before. And the kinds of people I write about are not the kinds of people who are, I mean, I rarely write about people in a way that makes them look bad. And so people have always been happy to speak to me. Mm-hmm. It would be different if I, you know, was Kitty Kelly or something.
You've been with The New Yorker since 1996?
That's right, yeah.
When you look back at your writing, because I'm sure you look back all the way to the beginnings and mm-hmm. thinking about putting this book together, do you see any real major changes?
Well, I'm a little bit more interested now in storytelling. In the beginning, I was much more interested in making arguments. And now I've become increasingly taken by ways in which you can tell stories about people and about ideas, but to use that kind of narrative form, which is just so much more compelling, I think.
In her review of this book in today's New York Times, Janet Maslin called them Malcolm Gladwell's greatest hits.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a reason for choosing some of them, that they had gotten real strong response from readers?
Yeah, they're the ones I like the most, with some exceptions. And you write, I don't know how many, I've probably written hundreds of thousands of words for The New Yorker. Some, and when you read them 5-6 years later, are dated, and some you realize were never any good to begin with. So it's actually not that difficult to identify the ones that that you'd want to collect.
The ones that hold up.
The ones that hold up, yeah.
You write in the introduction, good writing does not succeed or fail on the strength of its ability to persuade. Not the kind you'll find in this book anyway. It succeeds or fails on the strength of its ability to engage you, to make you think. And the stories that fill your pieces are often remarkable and engaging. But are you suggesting here that some of the larger arguments are still open to question?
Yeah, very much so. I don't think you can, no writer for The New Yorker or any other magazine can settle a case once and for all. I don't think that's what writers do. I think what we do is we introduce ideas into the mainstream, and others, and then, you know, we're trying to start conversations. We're not trying to finish them. And a lot of what I'm doing, I freely admit that I am taking a position and inviting responses. And it has never bothered me when people disagree with my conclusions, as long as they do so in a way that's as respectful of the idea in question as I hope I was in my piece. I just want to start conversations.
One of the pieces reminded me of a taste test that we did on the show many years ago, where we had three examples of ketchup or catsup, and everybody picked Heinz ketchup as their favorite. And you have to wonder why.
Yeah. That was that piece you're thinking about is a piece called The Ketchup Conundrum, and it was. I have this wonderful friend named David Diamond, who works in the grocery business for many years. And we once had this conversation. He pointed out to me that the most remarkable product in the supermarket is Heinz ketchup, that every other category has been divided up in a million different ways, you know, high-end, low-end, middle-end. You know, there are 50 different kinds of salt there are, except for ketchup. And Heinz just gets more and more dominant every year. So I wanted to write about why is Heinz the great anomaly?
And why, when you look at mustards, for example, the market has changed so much over the years, but this ketchup is pretty much the same product that Henry Heinz developed in 1907.
It's because I hasten to say I'm not in the pay of Heinz. it's because the argument, slightly whimsical argument made in the piece is that it's perfect. So it's this almost unknown example of a food that can't be improved, and that it hits every single, you know, if there are five tastes, sweet, sour, salty, umami, and
bitter,
it's the only one that hits all five.
Although when it was created, there was no such thing as umami. I mean, yes. There was umami, it just hadn't been
named. Identified, yeah. So it's this sort of, it's so hilarious to think of something so completely commonplace as Heinz ketchup as perfect. And that's one of the things I love doing in my writing is to try and find those things that we take for granted, that if you sort of turn them over, you discover all kinds of life underneath them.
I've wondered why, Del Monte ketchup is perfectly fine, but why haven't they been able to duplicate? And there have been some really fancy ketchups developed in recent years. Some of them are pretty good.
They're never as good. There's a guy, whose name, of course, escapes me, who's the world's leading expert on ketchup.
There's an expert on ketchup?
Oh, yeah. And I had lunch with him when I was writing the piece, and we went through all the ketchups, and it was so funny. And he said, you know, to a ketchup aficionado such as himself, he can very clearly tell the difference between Del Monte and Heinz. It has to do keeping the variability of the tomatoes in check, because tomatoes come in all kinds of consistencies and tastes and sizes. And in order to keep the sort of ratio of liquids to solid, you know, all the kinds of things you have to worry about, organizing and maintaining and regulating that variability is one of the keys to great ketchup. And Heinz appears to have done that.
My guest is Malcolm Gladwell, whose latest book is a collection of his pieces for The New Yorker under the title What the Dog Saw and Other Adventures. It's published by Little Brown. One of the pieces involves you. The piece on plagiarism called Something Borrowed, you write about the experience of discovering that a playwright had stolen words and descriptions from a profile that you'd written of a psychiatrist named Dorothy Lewis.
Yeah.
Now, this is a British playwright.
Yes.
Reading The New Yorker?
Byron E. Lavery, a British playwright, an award-winning British playwright, had a play on Broadway called Damaged, and it turns out it's several hundred words of that play were lifted verbatim from an article I'd written for The New Yorker. And that piece describes the evolution of my thinking about what had happened. I started out being, as every writer is, all huffy and puffy about it. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized, why am I so upset? You know, do we have, as writers, have we kind of overreacted to this quote-unquote crime? And is it unfair to lump all acts of borrowing together? And that's what that piece is about, is trying to figure out, well, what is it wrong to take someone's words, and when is it actually totally fine, forgivable?
Well, I saw that production, and I thought it was very effective. And if somebody had said to me, well, you know, this was based on a piece that Malcolm Gladwell wrote for The New Yorker, I would have said, well, yeah, but in the end, it's a very effective play.
And it's the key thing for me. I read the play as well, and when I read it, I was I was so moved. It's an extraordinarily powerful work of art. And what she had done is borrowed several hundred very ordinary words of mine that weren't central to my art, you know, and just used them as one small building block in the cause of making, I thought, an extraordinary work of art. That's fine. I have no reason to get upset with that.
How did you even learn that she had done this?
Because the psychiatrist, Dorothy Lewis, who had been the subject of my profile and whose story is kind of transformed in the course of Making Damaged, she found out about it. She went to see the play and recognized some of the passages and then contacted me.
And she was much more upset than you.
She was
you.
More upset.
She sued at one point, didn't
she? Did. There was some, it didn't go very far, but she did. I mean, in a certain sense, understandably, because it was her life that she felt had been borrowed. Although
the character wasn't named Dorothy Lewis.
Yeah. One of the points I make in the piece is that she was clearly part of the inspiration for the character, but was not. The character wasn't Dorothy. It was someone different. And that's the thing we have to understand, those of us in any kind of creative field, is that we're always borrowing things and transforming things. That's called creativity.
There is a cliche, imitation is the highest form of flattery. And yeah. Didn't T.S. Eliot once say, immature poets imitate, mature poets steal?
Yes, that's right.
So when did this change? When did we go from a time when it was when a great poet could say, well, yeah I steal stuff,
yeah,
to people suing because some of their words were appropriated by another writer?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, there has been a certain move towards sort of the fetishization of intellectual property in recent years. But I will say, this is not to say that all acts of borrowing are inappropriate. I mean, one of the clear points I make in the piece is there are clearly times when if you steal someone's words, you are doing them an injury. But it is not fair to say that all theft of words is. And I think that we've just been indiscriminate in how we use that word plagiarism.
Well, part of the problem is when we are in high school and we just simply copy the thing from Wikipedia and a teacher discovers it, we get in serious trouble. And we apply those same standards to a historian who borrows a paragraph or two from some other person's writing.
Yeah, one of the distinctions that I was interested in making in that piece is when you are borrowing someone's work and using it in the same spirit as the person you borrowed from, that's a problem. So if you're writing a history of Napoleon and you borrow from someone's history of Napoleon without attribution, you deserve to be, you know, to be lashed with the... If, however, you do what Byron Lavery did, which is borrow from a profile in The New Yorker to construct something entirely new and beautiful and moving, which departs from the original work, that to me is fine. I wasn't done an injury by that.
And it's interesting that we don't apply the same rules to the visual arts and especially to music. We're quoting somebody else's musical theme. In fact, composers often write themes based on other people's themes.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was funny. I went to see a taping of the Elvis Costello Show spectacle a couple weeks ago, and I was reminded of how lovely musicians are on this point. Much of that show was given over to Elvis Costello and the people he brought on, talking about their influences, right? Very openly, this is a clear and beautiful strand in music where you think of yourself as standing on the shoulders of your forebears. And Elvis Costello would go on and on, what he learned from Alan Toussaint or what he took from Nick Lowe or, you know, but with writers, we have this thing that are, you know, we like to pretend that we made it up all ourselves.
Although we're inconsistent even there. George Harrison was sued and lost because My Sweet Lord sounded too much like He's So Fine.
Yes, that's right.
And it did sound very much like He's So Fine.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Including, I think, even the bridge. So I guess the feeling is if, as you said earlier, if we use it to make something better or and it's obvious that it's not just simply theft, then it's okay. Otherwise, it may be a problem. So what happened to Bryony Lavery? She was a famous playwright in England, but I haven't seen anything of hers in this country. Are they afraid to bring her works over?
No, I don't think there's been any long-term consequences. I mean, I think she handled it very well. In the piece, I describe how she came to my apartment and she apologized and we talked about it. And I think once people understood that what she had done was in the service of something greater, they forgave her, as they should. You know, she would have done it differently if she had thought it through. But I mean, I completely accepted her apology, and I think I'm quite sure will go on to do lots of wonderful things.
And I hope that you invited her to steal from you in the future.
Oh, I mean, listen, as I said to my friends, it's the only way I could ever get on Broadway.
Malcolm Gladwell's latest book is What the Dog Saw and Other Adventures. It is published by Little Brown. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Malcolm Gladwell. His latest book is a collection of feature pieces he has done for The New Yorker over the years under the title What the Dog Saw and Other Adventures. It is published by Little Brown. And let's talk a bit about that title essay, What the Dog Saw. Mm-hmm. It's about the dog whisperer, Cesar Millan. He was one of the most controversial guests we've ever had on the show. Many dog lovers wrote in to object to his form of dog training.
Yeah, I didn't get into that in the piece. I was less interested in. I know there is a kind of controversy. Although I hung out with him a lot when he was doing all of his work with dogs, and never saw anything I would have thought untoward. In fact, given what the dogs were doing before he got there, I would have thought we would give him a pat on the back. But I was really interested in.
People
why
care a lot about their pets, Malcolm.
They do, yes. His argument would be most of the pets he deals with would, if he didn't fix them, would be euthanized, which I think is a good argument. But he, I was just interested in why don't dogs do that for me? Why do they do it for him? I mean, that was the issue, right? What is it they're seeing in him? And, the piece is really about, in the end, about what the way we move says about us, particularly to students of movement like dogs. You know, that's because they really are the world's great students of movement.
Now, this leads me to an important point. Your pieces are not about a thing. Mm-hmm. It may start off talking about training dogs and then move into totally other areas. Mm-hmm. And that has become an approach that you've developed over the years. We didn't get into that when we were talking about ketchup mm-hmm. or when we were talking about plagiarism. But part of the fun is following mm-hmm. your train of thought in these essays. And yeah. Isn't that what an essay is to some degree, which is coming up with some thought and then following it wherever it goes?
Yeah. I mean, there's a kind of, that's why I say in the title, Another Adventures. I think of them as adventures. The one I'm, along these lines, I'm proudest of, one of them's the proudest of, is a piece about mammography and bombing, or in intelligence. It's all about, you know, in the military world, they take pictures of things to decide what to bomb, what not to bomb, what's there, what's not there, in the course of gathering information about enemies. And in the world of mammography, we take a picture of a breast and try to figure out what's there. And they seem like they have nothing in common. They have a lot in common, that the mammographer, the radiologist, and the intelligence analyst are involved in the same process, think a lot alike, and face the same problems. And the basic, and that's that whole piece I wrote was, it came from, because I was thinking of writing about mammography and went to see this really interesting radiologist uptown. And he started talking about, that was right in the middle of that controversy over the intelligence pictures that the Bush administration said showed that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. And this radiologist started talking about that. And with great sympathy for the analysts, he knew what they were going through because he spends his whole life looking at pictures that may or may not show something that's troubling. And he knew how hard it was. And he also knew, had struggled all the time with the fact that those of us in the kind of lay world think that a picture is proof of something. We think if you can take a picture of something, you can see what's real and true and meaningful about it. And he knew firsthand that pictures just, they invite confusion. They're just, he knew just how much subjectivity there was in looking. And that, when he said that, I just thought, what an interesting, this notion that this radiologist at Mount Sinai would feel such kinship with an intelligence analyst in the CIA. What an occasion for an essay. And so that essay is just about seeing. It's called The Picture Problem, but it's about this very issue.
It's about reading x-rays or reading photographs that are taken from 5,000 feet up.
Yeah, which is, and a mammogram is a picture taken from, at the most microscopic level imaginable, but they are strange. They strangely present the same problems of analysis.
Well, in some cases, it's led to important developments on a positive level. I don't know whether the Cuban Missile Crisis was positive, but it all worked out fine. Mm-hmm. In other cases, it did lead to confusion in the misreading of what was going on in Iraq.
Yeah, yeah. No, the issue...
And I suspect doctors run through the same thing. This could be a cancer or this could be something else.
Radiologists are the second most sued discipline, in large part because of this misunderstanding that people, sometimes the public assumes that once you've taken that picture, you should have been able to see everything there was to see. And the radiologist finds it difficult to explain. Actually, no. The picture can mislead as easily as it... As it tells us, what's wrong, and that was ambiguity that I wanted to explore in the piece.
Well, as we said, many of your pieces begin with a small, extraordinary anecdote which describes events that happened to a particular person on a particular day. But soon you expand the story to include bigger sociological phenomena and an argument about society or public policy. And I wonder what comes first in your writing and research, the thrilling anecdote or the big sociological argument that then leads you to the anecdote?
Well, there is no simple answer. Sometimes I run across a story so compelling that I want to tell it. I want to find a way to tell it. And sometimes I run across an idea so compelling that I want to find. So there's a piece in the collection called Late Bloomers, which is sort of celebration of the late bloomer. But
you also talk about early bloomers.
Yes, I contrast them with prodigies. And that's this piece that contrasts Jonathan Safran Foer, who is an extraordinary prodigy.
His first novel written at 19.
With Ben Fountain, who's a novelist who writes a incredible a book of short stories called Brief Encounters with Che Guevara in his late 40s after spending 20 years writing. And I wanted to... That piece is all about how the late bloomer deserves the same degree of congratulation as the prodigy. We're in love with prodigies, and we have a kind of slightly skeptical notion about late bloomers. But that was all prompted by this really wonderful work by an economist named David Galenson, who wrote about this whole idea of separating out late bloomers from prodigies. And I just wanted to write about Galenson and enlarge the argument. So I looked and looked and looked for what the right story was to tell, to go along with that, with this sort of beautiful conceptual distinction he had made between what he calls experimental and conceptual innovators.
I think... Because you didn't deal with the third type of late bloomer, the really late bloomer, like Lampedusa, who wrote The Leopard, I think, in his 60s or 70s or 80s,
70s.
Whatever.
Yeah.
They get the same kind of attention that the prodigy gets because we're surprised that somebody could pull off something so wonderful at such a late age. But it's the 40-year-old late bloomer who has the problem.
Yes, it is the...
mid-career. You're supposed to be mid-career at that point.
That's right. But one of the points that Galenson, the guy whose work I was basing that essay on, one of the things he points out is that an awful lot of... We forget just how many cultural, creative stalwarts don't hit their stride until their late 40s. The greatest stretch of movie making maybe ever done is by Alfred Hitchcock in his late 50s when he does Vertigo and This whole, he does like seven or eight of his greatest works right at the end of his active career. I mean, or Mark Twain publishes Huck Finn when he's 50. Or, you know, I could go on, but Gilson very beautifully says, and Cézanne is the one I talk about in the, and that's the one Gilson writes a lot about. I mean, Cézanne, you go into the Musée d'Orsay and look at the works that he has collected there. They're all painted. They're all painted by him when he's in his late 50s, early 60s. I mean, it's something to remember.
And then even sadder for Cézanne, he's not appreciated until the last few years of his life.
Yeah, yeah. He's not. I don't even think he has his own show until he's in his 50s.
Well, what is it? That says as much about society as anything else, doesn't it?
Well, it's funny. I don't know enough about art to be definitive on this, but when I was reading sort of art criticism for that piece, it's not just that he was unrecognized when he was younger. It's that his stuff was not good yet. I mean, he took a long time to get good.
Yeah, but then he got good, and he had a real impact on a lot of other artists, but he still wasn't becoming famous.
Yeah. Well, he was friends with... There's that lovely moment in French painting where, you know, every famous name you've ever heard of, and they were all hanging out in the same cafe. So, you know, it's sort of odd to think back.
Don't you wish there were a place like that? They used to be in New York, by the way. There used to be places that all the artists hung out in.
Yes.
The Cedar Bar, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's all lost in the
Well, we don't
city.
Drink the same way we did. I think that's the difference.
Or maybe we're not as collegial as we used to be.
Yeah.
Because there also was an artist club in the old days. We don't have anything like that today. My guest is Malcolm Gladwell, whose latest book is What the Dog Saw and Other Adventures, published by Little Brown. Do New Yorker writers hang out together?
I hang out with writers, but not, I mean, aside from one or two. I don't think we have, it's not like the days of the Round Table at the Algonquin. Or maybe it is, and I'm just not invited. I have no idea.
I wonder what leads you to a book idea. This is the same question you ask short story writers. What leads to a feature article, and what leads to the outliers?
Well, the same impulse. I mean, that I like, you know, you want something to occupy your imagination. And a book has to be the kind of thing that can occupy your imagination for 2 years. And an article has to be something that could have kept. And at the same time, there are, you know, I have an editor. My editor, Henry, is you know, wondering what I'm doing next. So there's a kind of very simple sorts of peer pressures that are really important. I mean, you know, it's if you have someone calling you up and asking you what's next, I suppose you feel wanted, don't you? So there's no better motivation than that.
Well, I connected to a few of these articles, especially the one called The Pitchman, because I used to be in that business.
Oh, really?
Ron Popeil, who gave us all of those things, the Vegematic, the Chop-O-Matic, et cetera. I used to sell stuff. Oh, I worked for a company that sold stuff on television, including one of his products, a product that he had abandoned and we made a fortune on. It was a kind of, I think it was called the Planetary Mixer, and it was... A mixer where you had a hand crank, and then inside there were these beaters that all went around, but then the whole thing went around as well, just like planets going around the sun.
Oh, I see.
And you could whip up whipped cream in a minute.
Do you still use it?
I lost it in a divorce settlement, but I loved it. I loved it. But he is an extraordinary person, and he is somewhere between a real genius and a huckster, isn't he?
Yeah.
Not a huckster, but almost like he comes out of the carnival.
He comes out of that. And his family, you know, his father, the legendary S.J. Popeil, who is part of this family of kitchen gadget inventors and boardwalk salesman from Atlantic City. There's this long, rich heritage behind Ron Popeil, which is one of the many things that makes him so fascinating, that many of those products you named are actually his dad's products. SJ does the Chop-O-Matic and the Vegematic, and Ron starts to sell them on television. That was Ron's great insight. SJ is the one who is one of the single greatest lines. S.J. Popeil did the pocket fisherman, and when someone complained to him that it didn't work, he turned to him and said, "It's not for using, it's for giving." I thought that was so fantastic.
Well, Ron Popeil developed the Showtime rotisserie, which is a fabulous product.
I have one. I cook up chickens all the time. It's a work of genius. I honestly think, and I don't mean this, so often when we write about people like Ron Popeil, we write about them with a trace of condescension or mockery or irony. And it was very important when I wrote my piece, I think, that none of that be there, because I didn't feel any of that. I think he is legitimately a brilliant inventor and a kind of a one-of-a-kind American businessman. And we have much to learn from people like that.
But he comes out of another tradition, and so we're confused by him.
Yeah, he does come out of...
I mean, you almost expect him to be visiting a town in a wagon and saying, buy this potion.
Yeah, but it's not... I mean, one of the things, you know, that tradition ought to be dignified because it is a... If you look at those infomercials, and you know them, you know what the... They are about transparently describing... And selling, I mean, there is more misdirection and hucksterism in the standard 30-second television commercial than there is in the 15-minute infomercial. You can't hide in a 15-minute infomercial. Rather, what you are doing is showcasing as clearly as you can the legitimate strengths of your product. You can't fake it.
Even though we sold pretty good products to the company I work for, we used to hire the people who do those demonstrations in supermarkets because they know how to do it best. Yeah. But that's another...
Yeah. There's a great skill. I mean, Ron is wonderful on this question. In his day, he was one of the great carny people, boardwalk sellers.
We don't have a lot of time, but I want to talk about another one of the articles, Million Dollar Murray. Mm-hmm. About why problems like homelessness may be easier to solve than to manage.
Yeah. That was a piece that has still stayed with me. And it's just about this notion that when we think about homelessness, what we forget is that the hardcore homeless, left untreated, are an enormous burden on social services. And this Million Dollar Murray, the title character in the piece, is a man living on the streets of Reno who, when they stopped and figured it out, they realized was running up between $500,000 and $1 million a year in medical bills and jail bills and police bills and all those kinds of things. It would be cheaper to have given him an apartment and a full-time nurse than to let him stay on the street. And that insight is actually at the core of a revolution that's going on around the country in how we treat the hardcore homeless, that we are now getting serious about putting them in housing because we understand we can save money by doing that, not just help the people involved. And it's a really fascinating, it raises all kinds of interesting questions about our attitude and obligations towards those at the very bottom. And I've probably got more feedback from that piece than almost anything I've written in The New Yorker over the years.
Although there was also the talent myth, are smart people overrated? That I think upset some people.
Well, appropriately, I think.
A listener wants to know whether you think the term tipping point has become overused.
I can't complain. I think it's used very often to describe things that actually aren't tipping points. So it's probably like all of these catchphrases that eventually it starts to be overused, and then it'll die at some point, I think.
Who came up with the phrase?
The economist Thomas Schelling, I believe, or some other economist from the 40s or 50s, was used to describe neighborhood change, that moment when a neighborhood would go from being all white to heavily black. It was the tipping point. It was
because you saw an immediate, because it was a slow buildup and then suddenly a very quick change.
Each neighborhood in the 60s, when you had these neighborhoods change, once a neighborhood reached a certain percentage of black people, all the whites would leave, and that was known as the tipping point.
Malcolm Gladwell is a staff writer for The New Yorker. He was formerly a business and science reporter for The Washington Post. He's the author of a succession of bestsellers. And now his latest is called What the Dog Saw and Other Adventures. It's published by Little Brown. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Leonard.